This is a production of Cornell University.
SA meeting, November 6, 2008.
I met with the faculty chair of the Academic Integrity Hearing Board last week. We had a very positive meeting. And going forward, we're all going to be, Kate Sandy and I are going to be working with Dean Fry and Dean Walcott to basically sort of reform an ad hoc committee to consider the best way to go forward. So I just want to keep you guys informed about how that's going. So thanks. Any questions?
Any questions for Chris? Women's Issues Committee update by VP Miller.
I'm happy to announce that the Committee on Women's Issues met for the first time this semester on Monday.
A couple of years, that's right.
And the first time in a couple of years, so that's a great first step for us. I still want to advertise to any members on the SA. You are obligated to chair a committee, and this committee still doesn't need a chair. I mean, the technical name is the Women's Resource Center Liaison, but you're essentially the chairperson of the meeting. So anyone interested in that, I still would like you to come to me and let me know. In the meantime, we've discussed with the Women's Resource Center, their board, certain policy changes they're looking at now. In particular, they're working very strongly with the Sexual Violence Resistance Network and looking to get consent education into part of our orientation program. That's a strong issue they've been dealing with over the last semester. So looking at moves on that, they're also looking to increase sexual health awareness on campus and other long-term issues mainly impacted at freshmen and incoming students. We're on meeting every Monday, and it's on the calendar, so you're more than welcome to attend. And like I said, I would still be a woman's issue on the day. I'm so very interested in that. Please let me know if you can. Thank you.
Thanks. We have any questions for Tony? We have a Janet, I think, announcement? J-Park. Announcement side, Representative Sally.
We've got our J-Park meeting yesterday. For those of you who were not able to attend, we're invited to schedule a meeting with Dorothy Hill's associate members. We're going to discuss how we can have more of a student voice on financial aid issues in the midst of this economic downturn. And we also encourage students in any kind of financial emergency to talk to their financial aid counselor, to go to the financial aid office.
Any questions for Rami? Rick, we have Representative Craig with an announcement.
Yes, I just had a little general announcement. Happy 2 days after history. We're going along with that. For those of you that were in College Town and around in the area, it's really something special for me to see sort of the activism of students on campus. And I think this day, in my eyes, for the first time I've been at this university other than Slope Day, let's say, just to see how excited students were, regardless of the outcome, regardless of whatever you have to think about it, just, focus on an issue. And so hopefully as we move forward, there's some way that we can tap this interest, the students' interest, for student government and get people more involved in our student government in that aspect. So happy 2 days, and keep on moving forward.
Thank you. Any questions? Any other announcements? I have some, but Director of Elections, McDermott.
Sorry, Chris, I'm talking to you back. I just want to let you guys know that yesterday the election committee met for their first meeting going over rules for this spring. I want to thank those of you that came or sent emails that aren't on the committee to give input. The main thing I want to let you guys know is that next week, Wednesday, November 12th, 4:30 in Stimson, technically right now 116, but if I feel there's overwhelming amount of people coming, we're going to get a room change because that room fits 10 people. I would like you all to come. From 4:30 to 5:30, we're going to have an open forum session where you guys can let us know about what your ideas are of the direct elections of president and vice president. That meeting for the election committee will be when we're setting objectives and brainstorming how that system will work. The rules will be written on the following Saturday, but that's our first brainstorming meeting to really set it up. So you guys do have oversight of this committee when it comes before you later in the year, But prior to getting there and having me rejected or have issues, I'd really like to hear from all of you. So email me or come to the meeting or see me so that we can have your ideas on how you guys want this whole thing to work so that we can incorporate all of your ideas into the rules process. This is something completely new. So please come. And that's 4:30 on Wednesday.
Thanks, Mike. Any questions for Mike? No. Okay. I have just a few announcements. Happy to inform you, actually. Our meeting on November 20th, we will have representatives from the consulting firm that I believe is through the campus planning committee, the master planning committee. They want to hear our input on, they want to hear our input on the master plan for housing and dining programs. And so they're going to be coming to us at that meeting at 6 o'clock. I want to let you know now, and I'll send an email. The meeting will be extended until 7:30. If people cannot stay, obviously that's understandable, but the meeting is extended until that time. They'll be providing us dinner, and it will be a great event. They're looking for our input in a lot of the 25-year plan for campus life and dining programs. So it's a very important meeting, and we're fortunate that they're reaching out to us and feeding us dinner. So hopefully we can just keep that in mind, and I'll send an email and look forward to that. Additionally, every week on Friday mornings, representatives from the SAFC and the SA and the Office of Assemblies have been meeting. I want to remind you again that you're all welcome. We're reviewing the allocation process of the student activities fee, focusing on SAFC funding. We're literally looking at it from as abstract as our mission statement and goals, and then how the allocation process should be aligned with those goals. So it's really theoretically we're revamping it, but you know it's going to take some time and a lot of discussion. I know a lot of you are, after hearing SFC appeals and et cetera, you have opinions about the issues, so I encourage you to come to those. It's a good forum for that. And those are Friday mornings at 10:30 in B12 of Day Hall every Friday. Last week, Slope Day, the Slope Day Programming Board. I know we're all waiting for those statistics from last last Slope Day about students who participated, the breakdown of undergraduate and graduate, so then we can address the online funding issue, the whole equity issue between SA and SA and GPSA. They'll be coming in next week, I believe, to present those statistics. So just wanted to update you on that. That's it for me. Any other announcements from the floor? Yeah, Randy.
I had a question.
Sure.
Have you found undergraduate students to fill the vacancies
that you haven't announced? There have actually been multiple people that have responded to me. I'm also waiting on my applications. There are online applications just like for every other committee. So I'm going to be working with the office to see if there are any online applications sent to them as well. And look for a decision. I actually just emailed Sandy Sutton this afternoon. She emailed me as well. She wants to get it done sooner rather than later, so we might expedite the process a little bit, so I might be willing to put a little more of these, people who come up right now and have, the desire to join the committee is also that. I might suggest them go ahead, but I'll talk to some committee chairs and I'll try to get a feel where everyone's CVs are and make sure it's something they get on one day and maybe talk to them a little bit more about it.
And so when are you accepting applications of this?
I'm waiting for Sandy to get back to me. I have a feeling she wants to be within a week or so, so we might expedite a little more than that.
But also just to clarify, the online application is always available, so people can apply well and throughout the year. You know, perhaps vacancies will come later on in the year, so we should, you can always have those names. Any questions? All right, moving on to business of the day. We have Vice President for Information Technologies, Colin McClure, with us today. Thanks very much. And I'll actually hand it over to Mike Hines, who will open up the discussion.
So, yeah. Copyrighted material
without permission and free of my down home that share a copyright of music and movies without permission to copy my folder. So a lot of peer-to-peer sharing that goes on in the world isn't strictly legal, and I'm sure you're all aware of that. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to see if it's sort of soft terms here, but it essentially involves the university's involvement in two different ways. If the entertainment industry representative believes that a computer that Cornell has transmitted copyrighted material without permission, our obligations as an institution are slightly different, depending on whether the person who is accused of doing that is an employee of the university, or whether the person who's been accused of doing that is not an employee of the university. So this means that if the accusation is that Paul McClure has uploaded copyrighted music, the university is legally responsible for that because I'm an employee of the university. If the accusation is that a student, for example, has uploaded copyrighted music, the university really is in a different position, namely, it's not legally responsible for the student's behavior. And our relationship to the issue becomes the same as any other internet service provider, because what we're doing is we're providing a network connection to the person in the residence hall, and we have no way of monitoring or controlling the behavior of private citizens who are using our network. So the way that the NCAA enforces it is that the music industry or the movie industry representatives that believe that they have evidence that an illegal act has taken place will send to the university what's called the NCAA note. Essentially, that says if we find that the accused offender is an employee, then we're responsible for stopping him right now and taking action to this material to clear the matter up. And we're potentially in a legally exposed position. If it's a student on the residence hall network, we're technically not required to do that. So that's the first point, is that we have been letting students know and asking that the material be removed for students because the university decided that it was really important that students know that the industry representative had detected copyrighted material that they thought the student didn't have permission to be transmitted, and given an opportunity to fix that situation rather than let it sit and potentially bring about personal exposure. So we have been, asking anyone for whom we get those notices, students or employees, to take the offending material down or explain why it's not offending. If you don't believe it's illegal, then you certainly are free to argue that. The second thing that happens, and we get many, many, many NCAA notices every week, and what we do is we send an email and ask the person to take action, which is cleared up at the beginning. The second thing that has been happening over about the last year is the entertainment industry has been taking a second step, which is sends what's called a settlement letter to the university and asks the university to forward that settlement letter to the standing to choose. We were looking for as you guys know, the life of the person is associated with the computer. And so the industry sends us some of them and answers forwarded to the relevant person. Of course, we don't want to just tell them to the person, because we'd rather forward the letter to the person. Again, that's a choice that the university may have to forward those to students. The reason being that what the settlement letter says is, we believe that you have sensitive copyrighted material without permission, and we're about to issue a subpoena for the following kinds of information to document the case and take legal action against you under the DMCA. In the settlement letter, they also say, however, if you will contact us in the following way, we can arrange to settle this matter before we go through the subpoena and legal process. And many people have taken action on that, paid the industry representatives $2,000 or $3,000. That I don't know because I'm not involved in that transaction, but I'm told that that's the kind of settlement amount that sometimes is agreed upon. The conundrum here is that we're not legally required to send the DMCA notices and engage in the take-it-down procedures that we have been pursuing. Nor are we required to forward the settlement letter. We could throw them in the trash, or we could go back to the industry representative and say, we're not going to forward the letter. And we're legally bound to do it, both of those things. The issue recently was pointed before that when we started the process that I just described of forwarding the DMCA notices and the settlement letters, the administrator all did that in the belief that it was our student leaders to know that they had been identified for potential illegal activity and to give them the opportunity to take advantage of the settlement offered by the industry rather than not responding and potentially being in a much more costly legal situation. More recently, people have said, you know, universities have really put themselves in a difficult position and maybe even aided the entertainment industry in going so intensely after higher education by being so wrong and forwarding these things on. Maybe we should have just said, it's not our problem, and we'll be able to do this, I think, to do that. So, the question here, and I'm not asking you to decide this issue, because really it's the same law in this area, we have to make the decisions in the end on many, many, many criteria. But one of the criteria that they asked me to sort of get a read about was, what do students think about this? Do you think it's to your advantage for us to do what we've been doing with the DMCA notices and forward the settlement letters? Or do you think it would be better if the university just said it's not our problem and stepped out of the picture? So that's really the question. I'm interested in this context, what your thoughts are.
Great. Well, first of all, I can't thank you enough for reaching out to us, because obviously there are advantages and disadvantages of pursuing both options. And so thank you. I have questions, and then we'll open up the speaker's list for questions or for comments or discussion and debate. I understand the settlement letters. You can sort of arrange a settlement or some compensation before going to court. Now, the DMCA notices, can you just clarify what that is again and how it's different from the settlement letters?
The DMCA notices, there are many more of those than there are settlement letters. And they essentially ask us to cease and desist the alleged infringement. And so if it's the university employee, you do cease and desist. And we do it right away, and there's no questions asked. If what we do, I think, is mock the IP address and communicate with the person who we think is the owner of that computer and ask them if it is true that they've been doing what the industry says, would you please quit it? If not, you need to fire us or, you know, a compromise or something else, and there are other explanations, then clean up and we'll take the block off and you're ready to go. But I can even use it, put to the web page and get out of jail, no chat. Well, I think it's a horrible penalty. But it does let you know that someone is believing that we behave in an illegal way.
Okay. Great, thank you. Please, list is open. Representative Stein, keep your hands up until I make the eye contact so I can get you on.
Hi, I just wanted to echo President Lavender. Thank you so much for coming. Now, I had a quick question about the settlement letters. Theoretically, if we didn't forward them, I imagine that the industry could subpoena the names of the people connected to the IP addresses. Is that correct?
Yes.
And do we have any idea, sort of, you know, what the cost of that would be?
To the industry?
Yes.
I don't know. It's not influential.
Now, I mean, I'll just throw my perspective. I definitely think that we should notify students and give them the DMCA notice on it. But I'm conflicted on whether or not we should actually assist the industry in prosecuting these students. I mean, obviously, as a university, we should not condone any illegal behavior. But I believe that the sum is closer to $3,000 than $2,000, and sometimes even exceeds $3,000. And that's an extraordinary financial burden upon students. So, I mean, I think that if there's any way we can sort of, you know, get around that, then that would definitely be the best possible option. Perhaps we could, you know, institute some sort of JA-type offense, or we could keep the block on people's computers for longer. I know at some universities, they block their computer for a very lengthy period of time, even after you clean it up. And that actually worked at other schools to sort of curb this illegal downloading, as friends have happened to. And we have not downloaded anything illegal since, but I know on a much larger scale that that's generally the truth. So maybe we could look at something like that as opposed to actually helping the industry. And
let me clarify one thing. By forwarding the settlement letters, we're not helping the industry in any direct sense. That is, we don't tell them who the student is. All we do is pass on to the student the letters from the industry so that if the student chooses to take advantage of the opportunity to settle, they can do so.
Okay, I understood that then. And are students made aware that, you know, the industry doesn't know who they are and so they can sort of try and hide or anything like that? Because I imagine that if, you know, they were aware of that, then students probably wouldn't pay the settlement and they would wait for the industry to come after them. And if this happens on a large scale, as I imagine it must, that would pose some cost to the industry.
It would pose a cost to the industry. It would also pose a cost to students who end up being talking about it. And that's a conundrum.
Would they not have the opportunity to settle after that point? Because, I mean,
no, my understanding is that the offer to settle for $2,000 to $3,000 is contingent upon doing so in response to the settlement matter. And you see why the industry doesn't want to have to incur the cost of the legal proceedings that would be required to get the identity and the future of the legal matter.
Now, theoretically, if the university refused to forward the settlement letters, do you know what the industry's next steps would be? Would they, you know, subpoena the information and send out settlement letters themselves, or would the opportunity to settle no longer be open?
I don't have any way of knowing. They want to believe that they will subpoena the identity of the individual and pursue it, but whether that actually true 100% of the time, I have no way of knowing.
Have we looked at the university's law to sort of examine their policies and see, you know, sort of from practice what the industry does?
Well, the problem here, as you might guess, is that we don't even know what happens between the students and the industry when we come up with a settlement agreements, because from that point on, the transactions between the student and the industry representative. So we don't even know what happened to the Cornell students. Last year I tried to find out, and, you know, I couldn't get that information. So, no, we don't know quantitatively what happened to those institutions. Other university policies have been very similar to those at Cornell. That is, doing the DNCA process, many of most of these already sell the letters because it seems like it was the right thing to do. But everybody is rethinking this at the moment, which is why Cornell is rethinking it too.
Well, then,
I'm sorry, I have to move on with your large speech. Representative Latella.
Hi, actually, both of my questions are just going to be clarification.
Representative Cusick.
Hi, I agree with a lot of Rebecca's points, but I just wanted to ask as a point of information for myself. I'm not very tech savvy or even legal savvy, but how do the people from that entertainment industry get the information about the IP addresses from Cornell,
they have technology that actually goes through the network and looks right on your hard drive. It identifies the peer-to-peer software and if their copyrighted property that they think belongs to them in the peer-to-peer directory, they infer that you would be making that information available. That's a fine legal point, and some lawyers argue that just having copyrighted material is directly associated with a peer-to-peer file share program is the evidence that you actually share it. So that's a point that the courts would straighten out at some point in time, but that's what they do.
So basically, I know with Shakespeare and C++, they have almost rounds enough to. Okay, just wondering.
Representative Pine.
Yes. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that so the methods of setting forwarding limits are that students have a chance to settle this outside of a court in case the industry should come and want to bring the student to a lawsuit. And I mean, that sounds great to give the students the option to do this, except for the fact that a lot of times the industry, like you said, all they do is they see that you have copyrighted material that can peer-to-peer sharing folder, and a lot of times they might not have enough students to actually bring it to court. And a lot of times students don't know whether or not they could be convicted of, you know, file sharing or actually doing something wrong. They might not be guilty of anything. They might end up paying to an industry if it was just basically bullying them with these letters. So by not throwing the letters, the Cornell is basically protecting students from being bullied by these industries. Is that correct?
I don't think
so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Andrews.
Hi. Has the university ever been coming out of and or given the name of
I believe there has been one or two.
Just my point of view on the situation is that by forwarding these letters to the students, they're facilitating the process for and the entertainment industry to forward the students. The entertainment industry is being taught. So I was wondering, has the university ever thought of a system as in they return the letters to the entertainment industry today and says, we will not facilitate your job here, but we'll notify our students that you're trying to notify them. And in this process, you can see that if the entertainment industry wants to actually get the student, they'll have to go through a subpoena process. And then they can present their settlement letter once they had to go through and have to go through a more difficult system to get the student. Because I think this is by the way, you're allowing the student to do whatever it wants, you know, carpet
long. Well, the way it works actually, I think it's equivalent to what you're recommending. In other words, when we forward the settlement letter to you, we don't tell them who you are. We just give you a piece of paper and say, we let you know how to contact them if you choose to do so. If you don't choose to contact them, then the system, however they choose to play it out or play it out, we don't give them your identity when we forward the letter. You have to take contact with them if you wish to take action.
And also,
30 seconds.
Does the entertainment industry know that you're forwarding letters to students?
I think they do.
Okay. Representative Liaison Tata.
So I have one quick question. Just for my benefit. So are the students like here solely going to live in the rest of the hall or have the network as opposed to an individual office or the co-op, for example?
This question is that the university's involvement in this process is only when computers are connected to Cornell University's network. That could be in the residence halls or co-op if both are connected to the university's network. But if you live in an apartment in college town and you use Roadrunner as your internet service provider, Cornell is not involved in that. The unfortunate thing that's going on in the industry is that the industry representatives are targeting higher ed institutions and they're not targeting the broader internet service providers. So they don't send those letters to Time Warner telling them to go after you.
Why? Partly because it might encourage them to be an industry event. for the applicant to think about to get the maximum potential, whatever, out of it, if possible. But that's a second question. I would like to know, however, the settlement letters, you appear to really have the authority to protect students regardless of anything. I'm not really sure if I would count that as bullying, but rather if you take into account what the potential consequences could be, which could be massive.
Okay. Representative Dodger. Before we move on, actually, I had one further question. How much has the university council been consulted or has had any role in this issue at all? And I only ask because, you know, this wouldn't be something you would say to a representative from the RIAA or, you know, because I'm sure there are compliance issues with the law. But basically, I think the question is about that missing information. If you don't forward settlement letters, what's the probability that they really are going to subpoena students? I mean, I think that's what it comes down to, at least from our perspective. I think a lot of us looking out for student rights. I wouldn't say rights, I would say interests, student interests, because I guess we really have no rights in this sense. So that's my question, and I think it needs some legal advising, and so I'd be curious if the University Council has had any role in this conversation.
They don't know
already answered two of your questions about probability of retention.
Okay.
There are any facts.
Okay. Moving on, BT Miller.
I have met with Stephen Hubbell last Friday. We're actually talking about this issue. And the reason I wanted to actually report the administration sending letters to students so that they're aware of it, because he's telling me that, you know, when they get these pre-sent letters, yes, some do choose to act on them and it's a couple $1,000, but he's also told me of instances where they haven't. And where the record industry did go after them full force, you know, with all their legal strength, and these students went bankrupt. Their parents lost a ton of money. They were taking out loans just to pay for one movie or music song they downloaded and shared illegally, and it bankrupted them. It set their futures back entirely way too much. And although, in a larger sense, yeah, maybe it's wrong. I certainly think it's wrong with the record industry picking on college kids especially. I certainly think it's wrong with they're going after us. We should have a whole new debate on this whole technology and, you know, that's a larger issue. Right now, I think when I listen to this bracket thing, letting students know, hey, there is a chance that the record industry will come after you with the full legal force that they're entitled to, and you will be severely financially punished for infringement of the law. And so, you know, by letting the students know that this is a possibility, which has happened, I think Cornell is being very responsible and, you know, letting them know that it is a possibility. And like you said, I can't help but, you know, recognize it. You're not giving the names of the students when you board the letters. The record industry is still, they still are in the dark as far as they're, you know, as far as they're concerned. It's just the students are getting a little bit of an upper hand, but they have time to, you know, maybe think about it, you know, maybe consult, like you know, their own legal counsel. I would, however, recommend, I don't know exactly what they get in the pre-settlement letters, but if they got something, you know, ahead of time of the cover letter that says what you basically told us was your proof when you came in the first 4 minutes you spoke, I think it'd be very helpful so that they know, you know, yes, this is the legal aspect of it, but, you know, also, here is what our options were, here's how we got to this point, and the rest is up to you. But this is, we just want you to know exactly how we arrived at this place.
Thank you. Representative Salem.
Are there any repercussions on the university for not forwarding settlement letters?
I don't think there are. I'm sure there are not direct legal repercussions. For a long time, many universities believed that if the university was cooperating, I would give what they had and we forwarded the letters, that it might decrease the tension that the industry put on that university.
So those are sort of like blacklist of universities?
Well, Cornell has been fairly cooperative in the past, I was surprised, and the number of loans that we get is vastly less than any other institution in the size. People have thought, well, maybe being a little cooperative will cause them to, you know, pay less attention. I don't know whether that's true, of course. There's no way to know.
Also, I had a chance to meet with Tracy Matrona to speak about this, and she said basically that this whole tracking of illegal downloading by companies is pretty much like the dying industry, because over a matter of time, like, these flashing networks are going to be so ubiquitous and widespread that it's going to be like not profitable to continue, and I think like there's a pending bill of Congress to kind of, you know, work this out. But I was just wondering, as far as internal files and sharing networks go, are they pretty much protected, such as like DC++?
I don't know anything about DC++.
Because I heard that for the time being, they can't be tracked, but the RIAA has been known to, I guess, like, go on into university campuses with public computers, like they did in the University of Michigan, and Cornell obviously had public computers as well.
30 seconds.
And access the computers that way. And I was wondering maybe, like, if that were to happen, would there be any, like, tracking in place or, you know, prevention?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is I really don't know anything about what I can tell you is that file sharing of copyrighted materials without permission, whether it's on
Also, I was wondering, you made a distinction between students and employees when you were dealing with this, but under what category is where the students and employees fall under?
I would guess if the student was doing this in the office where they were working at the university, they would be considered an employee. If they were doing it in the student's tutor lab or at the university hall, they probably would be considered to be
at the student's tutor. Okay, sorry, we can go on the second speaker's list. Representative Kumar.
I just wanted to clarify, I think somebody was elaborating on this earlier. If the university doesn't fill the settlement letter and the record, the RIA, you know, goes to subpoenas for the student's record, when they actually make contact with the student, in all your conversations with the council and everything, have you found out whether that student is first, given the settlement letter directly?
I believe what the settlement letter itself says, which is the only thing I see, is that if you settle with the pre-settlement letter process, they will settle for X amount of dollars, and then it will be more than that if you try to settle at a later point. But I don't know what the dollar figures are of the second option.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just asking because, from what I've read, when they subpoenaed through private ISPs or whatever, they need an opportunity to settle out of court. So I wasn't sure if, they give students an opportunity to send the letter directly.
I believe they give them an opportunity to settle out of court at that point, but I'm sure the amount of money that they will require is more than if you just
send them in
the check, because they
incur
more cost to get there.
And my other question was, I read about like a law passed last year related something to fostering. Has that changed how the university goes about it?
They're talking about the Higher Education Authorization Act, which has requirements that universities file how we're going to get the exact word, curtail to the maximum extent possible, something like that. File share activities on campus, and file share require that we use quote technological intervention. That if there are devices which you can put on the network to recognize any kind of peer to peer traffic and block those transmissions. Cornell has resisted doing that, but depending on how the Department of Education states the regulations supporting that law, we would be required to do that.
Okay, Representative Kramer. Oh, before you, sorry. If there's anyone in the audience, a community member, who would like to ask a question or make a comment, just raise your hand and I'll put you on the speaker.
Thank you again for coming. Most of my things have been touched on, but I just wanted to clarify. As far as you know, there have only been one or two subpoenas so far?
I believe that's true.
Okay. And then so, my whole, I guess, focus is kind of on what Representative Miller said, is that the university does not want to give official advice or, a cover letter or something of that nature. I think it should be either, up to, I think what we need to do is figure out, how often, what are the exact chances that someone is going to get subpoenaed, so that these individuals can figure that out for themselves, so that they can look at this information and weigh their options. Because I believe a lot of the students on the network are at least going to be freshmen, or for the most part, going to be some, a few seniors or juniors and sophomores on West Campus. There are going to be primarily 3,000 students on North Campus that, by and large, are new to university life. And they may immediately just think that they're automatically going to be sued, or they're automatically going to, face this legislation, and they can, if they have it, they can get out that $3,000 and, just write that check or whatever needs to be happened. But I think for students that may not necessarily be in that sort of position that need to figure out, you know, should you run into and get another loan, there should be at least some website, whether it's not, you know, authorized by Cornell's administration or whether it's something written by, you know, Cornell students who are interested in the computers or the network or something that they just, that's something that we should look into doing so that students have that information that they could go off and so that they make an educated decision, not just one that they're doing, you know, quickly to be able to settle this and not worry about it. The other thing, I mean, hopefully, you do not necessarily know much about C++, but I think a lot of my questions are coming from the change of what we heard in the C++ network. Because I believe, as most of us were under the impression last year, that since it was you had to be on Cornell's network in order to access that network, that people would not necessarily be able to sign it. So if there is any way for them to figure out exactly which network, you know, that you go onto a public site and download it peer-to-peer, or is it room-to-room or something of that nature, so that students could be more aware of that issue, that would be very helpful for all of us to educate our institution.
I think if you have questions about C++, you should identify the
I want to just respond. Actually, I will say we're only going to take 3 more from the speakers list. I want to respect Holly's time. I know we're all busy, and thank you for coming. You bring up some good points, and I have a question for you in the sense of what student assembly can do in terms of. So we just spoke about how students get these pre-settlement letters, and you know, again, you're giving this information to them to give them the opportunity to participate in the pre-settlement to avoid substantial costs later, potential substantial costs. And you know, you're not in a position. The university's not in a position where they can say, by the way, there have been only 1 or 2 subpoenas, and there have been X hundred amount of pre-settlement letters. You know, you're not doing that. The university cannot do that. Can the student assembly, just an idea, and I really would like to know, you know, in your opinion, what you think the SA can do with this situation. You know, what if there's, with those letters, there's also a letter from the student assembly that's not legal advice, I mean, obviously we can't do that, but it's something like maybe giving some more information that the university can't, maybe giving the statistics that maybe we can find from people, like there have been X amount of subpoenas versus X hundred amount of pre-settlement letters. Just want to give you this information. You should consult private counsel, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that that's appropriate? Do you think there is a potential? Do you think that's appropriate? What's your opinion on that?
Not being a lawyer and also having a mention to all the people that I work with to try and figure out how to do this, how do we want to, you know, make a commitment about what we want to do. But it might not be a bad idea in any circumstance for a group of students that is interested in researching the issue if you could find out that information to set it up on the website and make that generally available to students. That would be very valuable information. I don't know of a single place to go to find that, but you know, you have no course to
Great. No, great, thank you. And actually, we'll take 3 more of the speakers list and then I'll have some final thoughts. Representative Craig, you just spoke. Representative Baker. Pass. McDermott.
I just want to reiterate kind of what Ryan said. I think education is really important. And it obviously sounds like it's something that needs to come from the students. A lot of my questions were answered, but I have 2 questions. Do the freshmen receive anything when they come here about file sharing during orientation week or early on? If you could elaborate on that. And then the follow-up, so you can just answer all at once and save time, is you mentioned the JA is involved, and I was wondering, is the JA involved in an advising role, or that there is actual JA-able offenses that are go along with file sharing and, you know,
can Cornell prosecute internally?
Yes, freshmen are with the council about this issue. And this year, I wish I could draw up the URI for the interview, but we put out a very short, really cool video that sets out here's just what you need to know about this issue. And I really think the department for all freshmen who will be activated through the network connection to cast them through that video. So, yes.
Great.
Second question was
about the JA, and I know that you work with the JA when you're discussing this policy, but can the JA take or Cornell take action against the students?
Yes, they can. And I don't remember on the second or the third meeting of the CA. Okay. The first one and maybe the second, we can notify the student to do what I can, but if there are repeat offenses, it is referred to the JA. For the last year, there's been a required participation in online class that costs students, I think, $35 to sit through. So we try to get them with their freshmen and let them understand this. And then if they're repeat offenders, they have to pay $35 to sit through an hour long to try and get the educational point across.
So it sounds like there's the education when you come in as a freshman. On your first DMCA letter that the university receives, you get blocked until you go onto that website and clear yourself, explaining yes or no. And then following further DMCA letters, you could have to refer to the JA and take this hour-long course. And then something completely different is that pre-subpoena, pre-settlement letter. And that almost seems to be something that's handled very differently than the DMCA letter. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, that will be the last speaker on the speaker's list, because I do remember you had another issue you wanted to speak about. I don't know if you still wanted to, or maybe say that for another time. I know you're... You can... Okay, yes. Thank you.
The other issue is, and just to get you thinking about it, we're interested in the concept of electronic textbooks. You may know about the Kindle electronic book readers that Amazon sells. The company is interested in maybe doing an experiment with them. And the question would be,
so cool.
If you could get all of your textbooks electronically on an electronic reader, like Kindle, would say that you're carrying around a backpack full of 100 pounds of books. Typically, the electronic book is cheaper than paper book. It's a complicated discussion, a lot longer than this. But I am interested in
these
ideas about that. So maybe another discussion,
and maybe
we can organize
that. Sure, we can organize that. And then, so on an ending note, and thank you again for coming. I hope you have maybe, you've gauged some of our opinion. I don't know if you wanted a straw poll even for yay or nay. Have you received the feedback that you think you needed?
Let me try summarizing what I think I've heard here. Well, I think the general lay of the land. We don't any of us like this situation, but under the circumstances that exist, I think the general consensus is this is a good idea for Cornell administration to give our students all the information we have about the issue, and then also the students and the others can help provide counsel and additional resources that would be even better.
Great. I think that was my read as well, and I will tell you, seeing that, you know, this, I think this should be taken on by the student assembly, the CIT committee, I guess one of their charges will be for the rest of the semester and year to do all this research, speak to as many departments as we can, and see how we can educate or provide information, statistics, and advice without providing legal advice, because obviously we cannot do that. So that will be a charge to that committee, and again, thank you very much for reaching out. All right, thank you everyone for your input. moving on, so CIT committee, we got that. That was excellent. Moving on to unfinished business, we have student assembly absentee policies by D.C. Miller, Resolution 11.
I don't know. I'll note it. I don't know why they keep doing that. Thank you. I'll tell Laurie. It will reprint it again.
Ah, it's just reprinted.
You have 2 minutes. Oh, sorry. I'm going to interrupt you. It was reprinted because of the change.
The change was, yeah, it's not still accurate.
So it was reprinted because of the change, but they didn't get the change on.
Again, you know, for me, for the last 2 weeks, I think right now, just to kind of stop that measure so that before we do big charge change, we just allow everyone to keep their seats, you know, because I don't think the asset policy is okay right now. And also, look at the proper remediation between skewed and unskewed absences, just a little stopgap measure to make sure that no members run out of their seats because, you know, life happens.
Okay, speaker list is open. Representative Craig.
So I've been, you know, reading this article when we first got this a couple weeks ago, and I've been talking to some people. My sort of idea is, you know, changing it is, yes, it may be something that we can help save people, if that's the notion that we want to do. But I think we should look at it and see, you know, what is the perspective from the greatest student body? I mean, I think as though, since we are elected, you know, we're supposed to only miss picks because they're trying to get us here for every single one so that we could be good members of the student body and make sure that our constituencies are here. And, you know, we're saying, okay, so now maybe 7 is all right, maybe next year we'll say 8 is all right. I mean, it's just something to me where I just think this may not necessarily be the correct band-aid. I think something that we could look at in having in our rules, maybe what I mentioned with individuals was instead of, you know, there being you're immediately kicked off if you miss 6 or something of that nature, where you come to the FA during one of our meetings or during a closed session and then have something where you discuss why maybe are you missing all these meetings, what is going on, what needs to be done. We as members can talk about, well, you know, are you just saying, screw this, I'm sorry. Are you saying, you know, I'm not going to come and represent my constituencies and I'm just not taking my job seriously? I think that can be discussed at that sort of a meeting so that we can talk about that. But I'm not necessarily sure that, you know, changing the number is going to do the right thing. I feel as though we can be responsible to all our constituencies by making sure that they show up and not saying, you know, okay, as soon as somebody's taking another vacation, another day off, or something of that nature. Looking to doing that, working out the correct wording so that we can get such a meeting or such a session responsible. But that's just my point of view.
Representative Stein.
Currently, as I've just been saying, if you miss 6 meetings, rather, your seat is vacated. If there's someone to replace you, then you're replaced as a voting member. Most of us sitting at this table don't have someone to replace them. So one of the things to bear in mind is that what is best for our constituents? I mean, obviously having an FA member who is at every single meeting is the best thing, and that's what each and every one of us should strive for. But things come up, people get sick, people have holidays, and no one benefits by having an entire constituency unrepresented or represented by a non-voting liaison. I mean, everyone deserves to have a vote at the FA table. I'm definitely open to some of the ideas that Ace proposed, but I think regardless of what we decide in the end, we need to make sure that we're serving the students that we represent, and we can only do that if we're on the assembly.
Representative Andrews.
I got my one issue is the types of attendance problems and all that stuff. Is that, again, I think it is a bad signal to be sending to the student body. Sort of like, you know, can representatives, like elected officials, raise their pay in that election cycle? I mean, it's going to national, and there's a new attendance policy or whatnot. It should come into effect in the next year. You can't do that to your own, you know, to your own seat. You're essentially eating, you know, it's a distortion of power.
I appreciate the 25th Amendment Constitution as well. But on a smaller scale, I agree with 87, actually, in a lot of ways. we really do need to look at the broader picture of what members' responsibilities are. But I think it's actually why we have the charter review, the basic spearheading. And I know the case might be kind of the responsibility. So that's why I think we look at the bigger issue. Right now, I'm willing, if you guys can motion or whatever, I'll be friendly with it, to changing 20 to 21 and total 7 to total 6. If we want to send a message that we're not upping it, but we're taking that same number but clarifying it, because then we still have the clarification of the
We should make a motion if you want, an amendment.
Isn't that what it is right now? No, right now there's no delineation between accused and unaccused, which I do think actually first point out students as a whole. Because right now there's no difference between if you miss an absence or a valid reason, such as illness or family problems, or whether you just feel like it's not showing up.
Let me make a point of information, a clarification. We have treated it based on precedent, excused and unexcused. It's not in the charter or bylaws. It's just the number. So the other portion of this resolution is clarified. Okay, moving on. The next person to speak was Representative Diagra. Well, let me clarify that I was going to. If the seat is vacated for whatever reason, the next runner-up in the election fulfills the seat. There were a number. It was less than half, though, so it's not a majority. Number of seats that there is no next runner-up due to disqualifications or uncontested races. However, and if that is the case, then an at-large representative can go ahead and fill in any of those seats. Yes, they can be appointed, but an appointed representative wouldn't be able to have voting rights, and then a special election subsequently would be coordinated to fill a seat.
Point of information.
Yes.
Is it accurate that there is only one leftover at-large member who could theoretically fill a seat?
Right now? Mike, do you know the number?
I think
there's
one, but I just wanted to clarify that.
This is based on precedent of past decisions, yes. It's an at-large election. It's a fresh at-large election. I'm just saying precedent of past decisions.
For fresh at-large, you mean?
It's an at-large seat. Fresh.
But I thought maybe one of the if you have,
okay. We had a community member had a hand up.
Can you step up to the mic?
You're all set? Great. Representative Latella.
I'm Representative Miller. I have a question. Can you just clarify the considered vacated? Because I don't know what I'm thinking is it might be a better idea to have after a certain number, not necessarily the 7 total or the 3 unexcused in one semester, have that person be maybe brought before the e-board or brought before the student assembly and discuss maybe reasons why, because looking at the broader picture and for the better interest of students, maybe there are reasons that you can talk about without the considered vacating automatically destroying the amount.
Sure. Right now, the reason for it, considered vacating, I just don't like the reference to the charter. So I am actually not. I don't know exactly why the charter is worded like that, considered vacated. My interpretation from freshman has been considered vacated means that it's immediately vacated and we follow the procedures within the charter to fill a vacant seat. Why whoever did the last draft of the charter or used that phrase, I don't know. In terms of looking at the broader picture, we're going to be exactly the board of the student assembly as a You know, again, I mean, you can certainly look at that. That's
Okay, we're gonna, I would encourage, if people have suggested changes, I would encourage a motion to amend. That would be the most appropriate at this point. Representative Keesick.
I would just like to second
we looked at something in the charter. We paid a bunch of explaining.
What's the question?
Well, it's the considered vacated part. We're entertaining the thought of after someone is vacated, we're bringing them before the assembly before they're ultimately vacated.
That's not there, I was wrong.
But here's how it's currently written. Any voting members who are absent for 2 consecutive regularly scheduled meetings or for 6 regularly scheduled meetings cumulatively during their term will lose their right to vote in position if they're vacated. Then it goes on about how to fill the vacancy. So that's all that it says right now. There's no appeal process. There's no paperwork. There's no anything like that.
Do you have a point of information on the second speaker's work?
Just a clarification.
Yeah.
I will motion amend it if you can just clarify for me this for me. So if we move it to 21, what exactly, can you explain what exactly...
That's not some information. I have it on the second speaker. It was Representative Andrews.
I'm on the second.
You are. Thank you. Representative Smith. Okay. I'm moving. All right, there you go.
So, just so you might need to be up to speak on the first thing. Happy to work on the language to get a family member somewhere or whatever you want to do for that. But can you just explain then, if it's the same thing, what exactly the paragraph is doing on the conversation? Can you just describe the defining of excuse and excuse for me?
Sure. As it stands right now, when you email me with an excuse for missing a meeting, the only effect that has in having an excuse asked during the roll call is your ability to cast the proxy vote. If it's unexcused, you do not have the ability to pass the proxy vote. My rationale for my rationale is that if you have a legitimate excuse with my reference to operation field legitimate, and he or she will use that judgment, then legitimate excuses ought to be given more consideration with leniency and illegitimate excuses, such as right now. Excuse my family, I think when I was putting in, hard academic time, but clearly that's not hard. I just have family emergency, sickness,
20 seconds.
Religious obligations, things like that. Those are more excuses than, I just feel like showing up and not going to tell anyone on the e-board that I'm not coming today.
So that's time. You have there on your second speaker list, Representative Ryan.
I'll see you pretty much.
I think it is great in the way it is. The point of this was to differentiate between excused and unexcused, and so by doing that, he lowered the number of unexcused absences that are considered acceptable, and therefore it's more harsh excuses to sort of counterbalance that. He let you have one extra excused absence. I think that's perfect. I think that we should just learn this right now, and I call question.
Is there a call question? Is there a second? Is there any consent?
Consent.
It's the same. Okay. Okay, I think 30 seconds is 100%.
I think that there's still a lot of there's still a lot to discuss. I mean, I don't really feel like the issues have flushed out at all.
Okay. We're going to have to vote to vote, so we need a two-thirds majority to go ahead and vote. We'll do this by hand vote. So again, you're yay, you're raising your hand if you're in favor to vote. If you're not, please raise your hand if you're in favor of calling the question. All opposed?
Or 19 here. I already have count.
What's that?
So again?
Yeah.
I didn't count. I was counting
the
number.
Is that two-thirds?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, pass it upon the question. All right. Can you just, before we go into the call question, can you just clarify the change that's not on this document?
Sure, the only change is that 20 meetings during the year, because there are not 20 meetings during the semester.
Okay, the clerk, please call the roll.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Not here.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yes.
Yes.
There were no changes, right? Okay. Counting Mezzi? 13 yes, five no, zero abstentions.
Two thirds.
All right, I pass it. Thank you. What time? Okay. Moving on to unfinished business is Resolution 12, TNT handle test by Representative Smith. Speaker's list is VP Basil. Raise your hand. Sorry.
All right. This is my third year in assembly. This is the third time I've seen this same or similar resolution. It comes up every year, and it has failed for the last 2 years. Mainly, I'm just giving a little perspective right now, a little historical perspective. I feel so old and wise. Because of the issue that comes up every year, which is there are some assembly members who don't feel like an absence is an appropriate penalty for not completing the PNT handbook test. Very rarely is there anyone who's opposed to having members take the test. It's just they're opposed to the penalty for not taking the test. But that said, we've just voted on how to look at absences policy. But I feel like the penalty is entirely appropriate, and it's an entirely laudable goal to make assembly members more aware about what constitutes an appeal and all the different issues associated with SASC appeals, as we have all seen the last couple weeks, I guess. So I guess to conclude, I support Resolution 12.
Heinz?
I just don't think it's necessary to have something in our bylaws that says that you don't have to take the test because, people in the SAFC, they have to look through a bunch of, proposals and decide whether or not they're qualified. We don't have to do that. We're looking to appeal. So, if there's one specific case in question, I think when they come to the SAFC and when the appeals process, they'll just explain really quickly why they made the decision the way they did, and then we can look at all the different circumstances. But I don't think we have to be familiar with this rule and see it.
Representative Salem. Oh, sorry, Becca, you can respond to anything. Yes.
I think that's just, I don't think you can just be made aware of the rules when it's just like a certain type of thing. I mean, the point of the test is that you know just the background. It's not like specific little things. I mean, so you have a knowledge of it. I mean, just like the how we did it this year, just having Mezzi explain for 15 minutes the general rules. I mean, people can't process that. I think people can make very, very good decisions with just that little information. Because there's a lot of steps that are involved in this process, and I think it's important that we are aware of our own process and how they make it.
Thank you, Representative Salem.
Yeah, I think, I agree. I think there's a fundamental difference between hearing something for the first time or having someone tell you something and knowing it for yourself and, doing the background reading necessary to actually be aware of this. I think just coming from a student group perspective, why are they voting on something when they don't have complete familiarity with it? Just because, we're elected by the students. I think it's because we're elected by the students that, we should take their responsibility. And it's not even pretty strenuous test. It takes, a few minutes. You can't fail it. I don't see why there would be an added burden or anything.
Representative Sandoval.
Hi,
Representative Yao. Representative D.P. Miller.
Thank you. So, we also take a charter test at our retreat every fall because it's expected of the SA members to know their charter. Well, for those of you who, look at the charter, you'll know that the SAFC is a committee of the student assembly. So, by the logic, we ought to be familiar with our committee. In fact, it's probably our most important committee that we have. So I think it's actually very irresponsible to the students at Cornell University to say, well, we're going to take $77 from each of you, we're going to do whatever with it, and I'm still expecting us to read the rules, because that's as much as, it's our duty to be very responsible with the students' money that we're entrusted to allocate. It's our duty to know exactly how the appeals process works and how we get to the point where everyone comes to during an appeal. We need to understand the whole chain of events. Is it appropriate or not to? It's actually hurtful to the students if we don't have that information. Also, really, if you can't fail these classes, it's not hard to take Catholic tests. The odds of you not taking these tests are pretty slim. You're not going to really be penalized. It's a good idea.
Representative Andrews.
Two more. So I don't think I need to take the test. I just hope that when people actually take the test, that we are, that we remember, what is our point of hearing these appeals. We shouldn't always go exactly by the books, but I think it's important to hear everything.
Representative Stein.
I'm going to be perfectly honest here. I don't understand how anybody in this room could find that it's unnecessary to be familiar with the President and Treasurer's test. And of course the handbook as well. We allocate so much money to these different groups. This is not our money we're making a decision with. This is the students' money. We're hearing appeals. We're discussing, you know, the technicalities and why the FASB denied this appeal, whether or not they were correct. We can't possibly know whether or not they were correct unless we understand the rules ourselves. Additionally, I mean, personally, I mean, I guess for me it just seems so basic, but how can we understand what the members of the groups are dealing with if we don't understand the process ourselves? It's not a big deal. You can't fail. I mean, what's not to gain by having this test?
Representative Alonso.
Yeah, we agree. First of all, I mean, you can fail the test. You can fail it a few times, but you can take it a few times, and when you fail and you retake it, you learn. It just takes, you know, take half an hour maximum. Now, we'll learn.
Remedial campus.
I'm pretty sure that some people may have voted differently, you know, having read this and understanding exactly the details. I mean, it's not all the details, but it's the basic orientation and what it means to use and get and receive the money of the AFP. And that, I'm sure, would have changed a few of the votes, especially on the COLA talk. And this should not be a very contentious issue, and we should be prepared for these type of things. And the other and all the people are saying that we're allocating this money, we have to know how students are using it and what are the rules that regulate it. And if we don't have it, I mean, it makes it seem out of touch, and it makes it seem like we have no idea what the fuck is happening on the campus.
Representative Lepello.
All right, I just want to second Stein, B.C. Miller, and Representative Salem's point there. I think they're really important. We really should take this test. But in addition, for those that may think that the unexcused absence penalty, as D.T. Basil brought up, to be honest with you, I don't see a problem with that. I don't think many of you should see a problem with it. Because if you do show up to one of these meetings unprepared, not knowing the FAFC guidelines, I really think that's about the same as being excused, because you're not having, you know, you're not going to be having the knowledge of what's going on, and your vote, to be honest, really is not saying much, other than that you are unprepared. And also, anyone that's going to vote against this is, you know, you're just going to be lazy. So I really hope that you guys vote.
Yeah, I just want to second what you were saying. I think this is an absolutely fantastic idea. I think if anything, it will make us better, stronger as a group. And I think, too, you know, it's kind of bad to have these groups come in here who really, you know, want, you know, are expecting us to be professional, expecting us to know what we're talking about. I think it's really bad for, like, kind of whispering and asking each other questions about things that are kind of technical that you really should know anyway. And also, too, I mean, I personally never took the test, but I'm assuming it's not that, like, in depth. Is it really a, is it an intense test or is it that bad?
Or?
No. Okay. I don't know,
really,
but I feel like
y'all
sometimes do this once a year. So.
Is it one of those things that NASDAQ cannot make the best of that? Clerk, wait.
Just tell me to do that. I feel like having heard that.
I kind of hear both sides of the issue. I think, you know, sitting out for 2 years, especially last year when we were, you know, going through the whole process all semester, I was really drawn out. It really does help to have an understanding of exactly what needs to be going on, and all that is great and jazzy. But at the same time, I think, though, when we're talking about appeals process, I think it behooves us to have an understanding of the system, but not necessarily a great or, you know, a certain, we don't necessarily have to be exactly like the FASB, because the whole point of, to me, of the appeals process is to get a third opinion. Otherwise, if we're exactly the same as every other organization that they appeal to, perhaps, you know, what's the point of appealing at that point? So I feel like maybe, you know, an idea that we can look at is doing something like this or having some type of talk ingrained in our orientations in the fall. That can be something that's more incentive for students to show up to the orientation in the fall. And it's the whole point of orientation is to teach you about the charter, to teach you about information, so you know.
So I think that could be something that we would look at. But I didn't hear both sides. Representative Shaddy. Yeah, on that note, actually, as Chair, I'm calling the question. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a crack day, I'm sorry.
He prosecuted yes.
19-0. All right, folks, that concludes our meeting, our public meeting for today. We're going to go into executive session for the 5 minutes past right now. So anyone who's not a voting member, thank you for coming. We'll have to ask you.
See you later.
I'll send it to you later, too.
No, you can't.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.